The final case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Cad Aaron Blackburn. For the appellant, State of South Dakota is Mr. Andy Knack, Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. And for the appellee, Mr. Blackburn, is Mr. Paul Winter, the attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Knack, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. The state is bringing this appeal in order to challenge the trial court's ruling to suppress the evidence the law enforcement gained from the defendant, Mr. Blackburn, during the first part of an interview on the morning of November 10th. The facts and the situation before us arises from the circumstances surrounding the death of Tamara Magic. She was found dead in her home on the evening of November 8th of 2007. The ambulance that arrived immediately discerned that she had died a violent death. She had multiple stab wounds and a blunt force trauma to the head. A joint investigation was immediately begun by the Rapid City Police Department and the Pennington County Sheriff's Department. During the course of their investigation, they developed the defendant as a suspect in the victim's murder. Now, at the same time, the defendant was in Box Elder at the time, and he was pulled over by a Box Elder police officer on suspicion of driving under the influence. During the arrest, the police officer was informed that the defendant was a suspect in a homicide investigation, and he was arrested and brought to the Criminal Investigation Division in Rapid City. Now, at the time the interrogation began, it was, I believe, in the early morning hours of November 9th. Present were two officers from the Rapid City Police Department and two deputy sheriffs from the Pennington County Sheriff's Office. The defendant claimed at this time that he was drunk and he was high, and he did not want to speak to police at the time, and even if he did, he would only speak to Officer Matt Sargent, who he had known from his youth. The defendant had also invoked his right to counsel at this time. The police proceeded to question the defendant for a number of hours that morning, and the defendant did not reveal any inculpatory information to the law enforcement. The trial court ruled that the defendant had invoked his right to an attorney, and that the entire interview that morning was to be suppressed. And the state is not taking issue with that. The state is taking issue with the second interview, which happened some 30-odd hours after that, on around 9 o'clock in the morning on November 10th. The circumstances of that interview were defendant had been held in the Criminal Investigation Division in Rapid City all through the day on the 9th and throughout the night of the 9th and the 10th. And on the morning of the 10th, the defendant approached the desk officer on duty and said, "I want to speak to, or please contact Matt Sargent for me because I want to speak to him." At this time, the officer contacted Matt Sargent, and Matt Sargent came to the Criminal Investigation Division and proceeded to interview or interrogate again the defendant. This is the point where the trial court, I believe this is the crux of the state's issue. The trial court ruled that at the beginning of the interview, Matt Sargent had given the defendant his Miranda rights, and the trial court, in its opinion, say he was administered his Miranda rights and then made the statement of whether or not he wanted a lawyer. But the state at the time, at this time, would like to I'd like to expand on that, because it's the crux of our case is essentially that he had knowingly and voluntarily waived his Miranda rights at the beginning of the second interview. Specifically, and this is, I'm reading from the transcript now, after Matt Sargent confirmed with the defendant that the defendant had called him to speak to him, the following exchange took place. Matt Sargent says, "Before I ask you any questions, you must understand your rights. You have the continuing right to remain silent. Do you understand that?" The defendant replies, "Yes, sir." "Anything you say can be used against you in court. Do you understand that?" "Yes, sir." "You have the right to a lawyer for advice before we ask you any questions, and to have a lawyer with you during questioning. Do you understand that?" "Yes, sir." "If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for you before any questioning, if you wish. Do you understand that?" "Okay." "You understand that?" "I understand that." "Okay, if you decide to answer questions now without a lawyer present, you will still have the right to stop answering at any time until you talk to a lawyer. You understand that? Yes. Yes? Yep. Okay. You understand each of the rights I've explained to you? Yes. Keeping those rights in mind, do you wish to talk to us now? Yes. Now, the state is contending that that at this time the defendant had fully waived his Miranda rights, and he knowledgeably went forward with the rest of the interview.
Yeah, but the rest of the interview, he didn't really. There were no questions after that, were there?
I'm sorry?
There were no questions after he said yes. He went on to say, and then that's the issue that we have
yes.
here, is his next statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it came directly after he answered yes. There were no questions in between yes and his continuation of his answer.
No, Your Honor.
So you're saying in that brief instance, that broke the chain, and now, because it might be ambiguous, the officer didn't need to clarify. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am, and there's two arguments to make about that point. But what I'm saying is that at this point, we have objective evidence that the defendant knew what his rights were and voluntarily waived them. This is, I believe, the two tracks of inquiry on that are, I believe we, from the discussion in State versus Tuttle, referencing U.S. v. Davis, is that the questions of whether or not there's ambiguity in the initial waiver of the Miranda rights versus ambiguity in the post-waiver invocation of those rights is two separate inquiries. And the trial court viewed it as this statement that he makes immediately thereafter is actually a part of the waiver rather than a post-waiver invocation, and the state is arguing that he had already waived his rights at this time, and therefore any ambiguity did not need to be immediately cleared up because he was not.
When you watch the tape of this, it all comes right immediately.
Yes, it's we're not saying that there's some time period. It's just Matt Sargent says, okay, and then he says, onto the statement. And I'll read through the statement, because again, with the statement, I think it's important to understand the totality of what's happening as he's waiving his rights. The immediate statement that you're referring to, Your Honor, is the defendant says, I mean, I'd like there to be a lawyer present just so I don't step myself over the deep end or anything or nothing else. But I mean, at this point, I really don't see why there needs to be one, because I really want to know what you guys know. I was drunk the other night when I was talking to you. I was high on cocaine, and I really don't remember a whole lot of what I told you the other night, so I need to know what's going on so we can do damage control. So what do they know about Matt? And at this point, I think an objective police officer understands that his first statement about, well, I'd like there to be a lawyer present, but I don't think it's necessary, isn't really him making an ambiguous statement as much as it's him clarifying that his intent to go forward. He knows at this point, he says, I'd like there to be a lawyer present, and we read that as eventually, because later on in the interview he does clarify that. But at this point, the defendant has already volunteered to come in and meet with the police. He has already waived all of his rights previously. He makes this brief statement, and then he immediately launches into asking the officer questions about what happened. So he's initiating this dialogue with Matt Sargent, and I don't think that an objective police officer looking at this can say, well, I don't think that he wants to talk to me, or I'm confused about whether or not he wants a lawyer.
We say that we always look at these cases in the totality of the circumstances. We don't try to pinpoint one phrase or comment. We look at the whole body of facts here. So in that light, do we look at what happened the day before when he had repeatedly said, I want to remain silent, and that was ignored? Is that part of the totality?
I think it would be. I think it's something you certainly do need to look at. However, I think that any taint that may have arisen from law enforcement's improper conduct in that first interview, I think that was purged by the circumstances surrounding the beginning of the second interview, in that it had been more than 30 hours, around the area of 30 hours after the time the defendant had sobered up. He had been in holding that entire time, but then he proactively sought out the second interview. It wasn't that the police came down to the station and said, okay, we're picking up where we left off two nights ago. He was saying, well, I'm now ready to talk. I want you to come down and talk to me.
Are there any cases that address the significance? It's probably fairly unusual that the person incarcerated demands to talk to a specific police officer rather than the police officer seeking to talk to the defendant.
I believe there are one case. There was a brief comment in State versus Red Star. In that case, the defendant, it wasn't the defendant initiating the interview, but it was the defendant making comments to police officers who were escorting him to and from, I believe, the shower. And that was him volunteering. And I believe that it's State versus Tuttle, where this court had said that once someone invokes their right to counsel, the police can no longer initiate contact or question the defendant or the suspect unless that suspect himself initiates the proceedings with the police.
The issue here, as I understand the trial court's ruling, is that the trial court determined that his statements were voluntary.
Correct, Your Honor.
So that is not the issue. I think the issue here is whether or not he invoked his right to counsel.
Yes. That's precisely correct, Your Honor. So
whether or not he spoke to a particular officer or whatever, that's already been determined, and at this point in front of us, it's not challenged whether or not it's voluntary.
Correct, Your Honor. The issue is does this statement under our case law mean that he invoked his right to counsel? And I believe I mentioned before the two different inquiries have to be made about during the waiver process and the post-waiver implication, because the burdens actually shift, I believe, depending on what the circumstances are, whereas if it was a police officer just giving a suspect his Miranda warnings and the officer or the suspect makes an ambiguous statement, the officer must clarify that, whereas if he had already previously demonstrated knowledge of his Miranda rights, the officer is under no obligation to clarify that. And that is one layer of the state's argument. The second argument,
the rule isn't that you just have to have knowledge of your own rights. You have to have waived your right to counsel.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then try to revoke the right.
Correct. That's right. And I believe that in this instance, the defendant did not only demonstrate knowledge, but he also waived them. In his course of conduct, volunteering to speak to the police, and then specifically waiving them. And then also, this is another point brought up. The trial court ruled that after the statements, the statements made several, more than an hour into the interview, Matt Sargent had actually come back to noon. They'd taken a break, and Matt Sargent brought this up with the defendants again, his statement he made at the very beginning of the interview, and he said, I'll read it from the transcript. Also, in the very first start to our interview, you said you liked something to the extent about having a lawyer present, but you didn't think it was necessary right now. And the defendant answered, no, I don't. I don't feel it's necessary right now because you're sitting here. Okay. I don't believe that you'd let these guys push me into anything or anything like that. And then he says, right, Matt Sargent says, I just want to make sure that you're not telling me you want to stop this. No, no. Okay. That I'm not telling you that, Matt. I know that somewhere along the line in the proceedings, definitely, you know I'm going to need a lawyer and I don't want a PD. Yeah, and he says, it's not that I'm trying to stop the conversation. Okay. You know what I'm saying? And he specifically says, I'm willing to answer your questions without a lawyer. But sometimes during the proceedings, you know, I'd like to have contact with a lawyer.
Now, had that been done immediately at this original, when he made the statement about wanting a lawyer initially, we wouldn't even be here.
Well,
he would have clarified.
That would have been.
But he continues with all the interrogation. Blackburn tells him everything, and then he clarifies it later.
Well, I don't believe that this is a clarification in the sense that they weren't on the same page, that Matt Sargent didn't know what he meant when he said that, when he made that statement at the beginning of the interview. I believe this was just a, we're on the same page. I'm just double checking. I'm just making sure that I understood you properly. And if you listen to the tape and read the transcript, he comes right out and says, oh, no, that's not what that was. It's just he's basically demonstrating knowledge of how the system works, that he knows he's going to be a lawyer.
But doesn't, I think it's Davis, the United States Supreme Court Davis, they say you can't use, you can't use statements made after the initial invocation to make it ambiguous.
Yes.
That probably follows that maybe you can't. I mean, you can't look at statements he made later. You got to look at the statement he said. So we're really stuck with this original statement that he made on whether that's ambiguous or not.
The original statement you're referring to the beginning of the interview?
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, the question is was that an ambiguous statement? The state is arguing that it wasn't ambiguous because he was obviously. I think that this is just evidence that that was what his intent was, that at the time Matt Sargent understood that's what his intent was, and that everybody knew at that time that they were going forward with the interview. And I believe... And I'm not saying that that I'm arguing that this statement means that, well, we can take that and cut and paste it and put it back in the beginning and then, you know, shuffle things around to make what we say. I'm saying if you look at the totality of the circumstances, his actions, his course of conduct coupled with his statements, then I think it paints a picture that he knew what he was doing. He volunteered to come visit with the police. He knew he was waiving his rights. He knew that he needed a lawyer eventually, but he also knew what it meant to waive one now. Throughout the course of the interview, I think the defendant demonstrates a very deep knowledge of the criminal justice system. He talks about how long his rap sheet is. He says, I know I need to contact a lawyer, but I don't think one's necessary now. I've been trying to get in touch with some relatives, but, you know, and we'll work that out later. But he says, you know, I know that I'll need one, but I don't want one now.
Let me ask you this question. If we agree with the circuit court that he had not waived his rights when he answered yes and then proceeded on with this the rest of his request or conversation about a lawyer, then what happens? I mean, then is that the center of your argument, and that if we don't agree with you that he had waived it, that really then the circuit court has to be affirmed?
No, I believe my argument is, as you reiterated, that yes, this was initially a waiver, but even
let me say it this way. If this isn't a waiver, then under these circumstances, should the officer have clarified it at this point?
I think that at the beginning of the interview, if you say, we're not going to treat that as a waiver, and we're going to treat his statement as saying, well, that is part of the waiver and it is ambiguous, I would first argue that it was not ambiguous at all.
Okay,
but if this court says, well, that was part of the waiver and it was ambiguous, then I think that our case law does say he should have clarified it. And I'm not saying that at all.
I understand. You agree that is what the law would be.
Yes, sir.
Would you give any deference to the trial court at all on this? Any of its findings here?
The findings of fact, I believe so, but I believe everything that we're arguing about is a legal conclusion, which is reviewed.
The trial court looked at the same tape we can look at.
Yes, correct. The trial court looked at the tape, but the trial court made the legal determination that the beginning statement, the long statement he made, was actually part of the waiver as a legal matter and not as a factual matter. So I think it's a legal determination of whether or not he had waived his rights at that time. And one other thing I wanted to touch on, I know that the defense brings this up in their brief about, well, everything after this. The trial court ruled that everything after the statement of, I guess we'll call it the clarification statement, where he tells him specifically, no, I'm not trying to stop this, I want to talk to you about a lawyer. The trial court said that is admissible, and we're obviously not arguing with that. And in response that it maybe should be suppressed, the state simply argues that, well, at this point, he obviously is waiving his rights. He's obviously waiving his rights. He obviously knows what's going on, and there's simply no evidence that any of his conduct was, or that any of his statements were involuntary. And unless there are other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mack.
Thank you.
Mr. Leonard, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Can you please the court, counsel? I don't need an attorney present because you're sitting here, was the culmination of the inquiry regarding whether or not Mr. Blackburn, in fact, wished to have counsel present during his interrogation. The very reason that he's granted by our laws the opportunity to have counsel as a shield against improper police interrogation is the reason that he gives that he doesn't need one there. The totality of the circumstances is the standard by which the court must review the voluntariness of the waiver or of the statements and whether it was an intelligent and knowing waiver.
But the trial court has already decided that it was voluntary. That's not in front of us, is it?
I believe that the The case law indicates that the court must review as a parallel inquiry, is the terminology you find in South Dakota law, a parallel inquiry, the voluntariness as well as the knowing or intelligent nature of the waiver. I believe that one cannot be determined without the other, is my point. And I think that understanding why he believes that he doesn't need counsel is part of the totality of that circumstance, especially when his reason is that Matt Sargent, his former liaison officer, his coach, and the man who enters the first day into the interrogation room and says, "Get up, boy, give me a hug." The nature of that relationship and the rapport that they establish is part of the circumstances as to whether or not this man would believe that he needs counsel. Clearly, he didn't want to talk during the first 18 minutes when he invokes his right to remain silent so many times and his right to counsel twice. Now, during that period of time,
he did not invoke counsel the night before. He just invoked his right to remain silent, correct? I mean, he didn't want to talk to them.
He did not want to speak with them.
But
as I recall,
he did not invoke counsel, did he?
He did, I believe. Dale McCabe, Officer Dale McCabe from the Rapid City Police Department, took a turn babysitting him after they had asked him just to shut up and remain silent if he didn't want to talk for a while. And he says, I believe, something to the effect of, "If you don't do something here, I want an attorney." And McCabe says, "Okay." And then he says, "You know, I want a cigarette and an attorney, and like, quick."
Okay, but now that's not really part of this issue in front of us, is it?
I understand you're asking me about that. I feel it is. And I feel it is because I don't believe that the case law indicates otherwise. I think that it's...
But you did not file any kind of a... I mean, this has come up from us on an intermediate appeal, which it's a discretionary thing, which we've granted.
Yes.
You have not cross-appealed that or noticed a review or anything on this intermediate appeal. And that it's jurisdictional, is it not? And I don't know that you've waived it for future argument down the road someplace, but my understanding is the only thing we've taken here is the state's request for an intermediate appeal. And so the kinds of things you're arguing, I don't know that we have the jurisdiction the way we've taken this, the proceedings we've taken here, to even address your issue. And I'm not saying you waived it. I'm just saying at this proceeding, it's very limited to what we can look at.
The reason behind not taking a cross appeal on that issue or to notice error in that manner was that I don't believe that the voluntariness of the confession or the admission can be separated from the knowing and intelligent issue regarding the waiver. Because in the totality of the circumstances analysis, what has been going on throughout that entire time frame is relevant to both issues. And that you couldn't very well knowing and intelligently waive your right to counsel if you were brought to that point of being asked about those rights and whether you would waive them through coercive police techniques.
Okay, so what you're addressing then specifically is the state's analysis that when he answered yes, that's not a waiver. You say that's not a waiver. They say it is.
Yes. And I'm saying it's not a waiver only because it was equivocal and ambiguous, but because it wasn't made intelligently or knowingly. He didn't make it knowingly and intelligently because he is at that moment in that room pursuant to coercive police conduct. The reason I wanted to go back to the prior day to discuss it is to discuss why he made that phone call, why he got to that room, And I know it's not a but-for analysis, but it is the direct cause for his arrival in that room. The fact that he never would have been there but for that same officer's establishment of a rapport with him that makes him believe that he has in fact replaced the need for counsel. So when the state wanted to read to you today that his immediate response to the final inquiry, you know, you've been bringing up this counsel thing for so long. What did you mean by all that? Well, I didn't mean I really wanted one. I mean, you're sitting here, and you wouldn't let these guys push me into anything bad. What? Like admitting to the entire crime? I mean, that's where he's at that point. And that's when the judge at the circuit court level determined the clarification was okay and everything subsequent to it. Now, I couldn't find case law that said immediate clarification wasn't necessary. It had to be immediate when it's at the initial waiver. I don't think it's fair to say that in the sequence of events that... So do you waive these right? Yes. Okay. Well, I mean, I'd like to have an attorney present. I don't consider that post-waiver. I couldn't find a case that would indicate that would be post-waiver. Otherwise, you could have a law enforcement officer trained to just interrupt them when they say yes, and if before the but comes and call it post-waiver. That seems ludicrous. But I think that... It is equivocal, but I also believe it's not knowing and intelligent, nor voluntary, but, you know, even conceding, which I do not, that I can't discuss the voluntariness issue because I think it's parallel with that. But even conceding that, for purposes of argument, I think that the fact that he's there because he had an agreement the night before that Matt Sargent testified to at the suppression hearing as... he was getting his blood drawn around 6 in the morning, sometime an hour and a half after the recorded interview ended. And Matt discusses on the stand, well, we continued to talk, and I certainly was talking to him about the possibility of getting together again, at which point Mr. Blackburn responded, well, go home and get some sleep, and we can do that, however exactly he phrased it. And that agreement to speak again was made under the coercive atmosphere of the day before. So when he arrives, he makes the phone call to speak with him. Now, I can't imagine that you could ever contend that somebody, you know, waiver of their right once they've been given their Miranda warning. Well, let me phrase it this way. When somebody calls a law enforcement officer to them and wants to speak with them, it appears they want to do that without counsel to begin with. But in this circumstances, how would he get to the point of wanting to do that without counsel when he began fervently trying to enforce his right to remain silent in place, I would contend, his right to counsel the night before?
You know, what bothers me is it almost seems like the point at which he's at is that he knew he wasn't going to do anything. He wasn't going to get any place. He wasn't going to be able to go. He told the officers, I think from the record, 25 to 29 times the day before that he wasn't going to talk. And they continued to talk to him, you know, not just after the first time he said it, but the second time, the third time, all the way up to the 25th or the 29th time. But this has got to have an effect on him, knowing that he's not going to get any place unless he talks to some officer or something like this. And so it's like a stalemate. And so I can see where your argument comes from, that it's not voluntary.
And to add to that, he stewed in that jail over that just over 24-hour period. See, it's 6 in the morning. His blood is drawn. And, you know, he comes in at above the legal limit for purposes of driving analysis. You know, 5-6 hours after he was first stopped for the DUI. Then he's allowed to sleep for the day, and the next chance he has to make contact with the law enforcement officer is the next morning. Now, that morning is a Saturday morning, and he's not going to be going to court until Tuesday. He is not allowed contact with his family. The other troubling psychological technique used by law enforcement in this instance is the threat during the initial interrogation that he believed, Sergeant says, I believe you're lying. You're not a liar. Tad. I know you. But I believe you're lying. And I believe that you're at the end of your rope here. And he mixes his role as his savior by saying, and there's a knot at the end of the rope, your feet have slipped past, and you need to get back on it, and that knot is me. If you ever want to see the outside again, you need to get back on the rope. You're not a liar, but I think you're lying. And he tells him, what do you think would happen if I go to the court telling him you're a liar? That's what he has to think about before he makes that phone call. So that's the reason the prior day, I believe, is part of the analysis of the totality of the circumstances. I don't believe it would be appropriate to take it in the vacuum of those moments when he says, yes, yes, yes. I'm sure he thinks this is an exercise in futility. Why are you reading me my rights? That hasn't worked to this point. It's, why would it work now? And I think that to give the police the credit that their behavior would be deterred in any way, shape, or form, short of a suppression, is not going to happen. Let me put it that way.
Is there something to be said, though, about the fact that in the first series, his first statement, he repeatedly says, I'm not going to talk to you because I'm intoxicated and I might say something I don't mean to say. Doesn't that intimate that once he sobers up that he's going to want to talk to them?
I believe it does. I believe it would also mean it in anything he could say that I don't want to talk to you, but the reason that he gives shouldn't carry much weight. If he said, I don't want to talk to you because I'm not feeling well right now. I don't want to talk to you because I feel that I need to think about this for a while. I don't think that you can draw a line at this point in this line of jurisprudence that would create a new area of the law that if he gives you a reason to maybe come back, I think that would open the floodgates for any waiver like that. I believe that when he says, I'm drunk, in all fairness, he does numerous times say, and I believe the first time, I'm not talking to anybody because I'm drunk. Then they bring up the Matt Sargent role. What about Matt? I'm not talking to Matt. And at one point, unequivocally says, I'm not talking to anyone, including Matt.
Doesn't that also suggest that he really knew and understood his role to counsel?
I believe he absolutely understood his right to counsel at that point. And I believe that he understood his right to remain silent. And I believe that his age, experience, background, and criminal record is where he gained that experience and that knowledge. Clearly, he wasn't a great student or the most intelligent person. But he really believed that he could stop that with that type of response. But what he learns by the next day is that has no effect, not this time. He has never been charged with something this serious. His rap sheet indicated a grand theft he did some time for on the floor. I'm sure he thinks the rules have changed. Now, that's all assumption. I'm not acting like that. I can know what was in his head. I stood there in front of many, that's speculation, I know, Your Honor, many times. But I believe that's a logical conclusion, and one the state can't prove beyond even a preponderance, that couldn't probably be as real as the fact that he knew the next day what his rights were. I think that had been drubbed out of him by the course of conduct that he did.
Let's go back to the first argument on the need for clarification. You know, there's really three phrases that are involved here. And they all come almost contemporaneous. First, he's advising his rights, gets through with it. He's asked, do you want a lawyer? He says, no. Next phrase, I mean, like, I would like there to be a lawyer present. That phrase suggesting maybe something with Bubba. But right on the heels of that, he says, but at this point, I really don't know. I really don't see why there needs to be. That's his last word on this subject. Why shouldn't we take that as his last intention with respect to this issue?
I think that to do that, you would have to say that there was an ambiguity created, but then resolved again by saying, but. I think the first but is where the ambiguity is created, and then it's incumbent on the law enforcement to clarify. I want to talk to you, yes, to the waiver. And then I mean, I'd like there to be an attorney present. I think that right there the ambiguity is created. He says, well, but I still want to talk to you.
Are you suggesting the police should have stopped before he finished his answer when he gave his last but? You know, he gave his last but, which was, you know, but I don't see the need for one now. Are you saying that they should have stopped him before he got that out?
Maybe if he was quick enough, and he seems quick enough to stop him a lot of times, but I think that it is the ambiguity created by his reference to wanting an attorney that calls for the clarification at that point. If he had said, I'd really like there to be one present, but I don't see why there needs to be one right now. I mean, but I'd like there to be one present, but I don't know why there needs to be one now. If you continue that, well, I think the ambiguity remains.
But he didn't say, but I don't know whether there needs to be one now. He said, but at this point, I don't really see why there needs to be one.
Right. I understand. I think that the law enforcement in South Dakota, the law in this South Dakota, indicates that if at the time of the waiver there's a question, and I think it was created, in this case, at the time of the waiver, that a clarification should have occurred, and it doesn't occur the first 2 hours. And to understand the mindset of Sergeant again for the rest of the waiver, or whether it was knowing, intelligent, or voluntary, you can even look at how the entire interview ends. The interview ends with Sergeant begging for that he doesn't want problems. His very last line in the interview, in the last interrogation was, but I don't want no problems. What led to that was, you guys know I'm not looking for a lawyer, right? I mean, I'll talk to you. So does that help or hurt me as his attorney when I try to argue that he wasn't knowingly and intelligently waiving his rights? I think it helps. And the reason for that is, it is a continuation of the agreement that he had. Thank you.
But you don't want us, under Davis, and as a matter of law, I can't see how you want us to consider the stuff that happened later.
No.
Because he pretty clearly indicates later that he never wanted a lawyer.
I wouldn't want it considered in a vacuum, Your Honor, that's for sure. That's why I think if you look at those statements in the context of what his state of mind was at the time, why would he make those statements and what did he mean by them? Because much of what he says regarding attorneys is ambiguous. I'd like to call my mom. You know, that's the only way I can get a lawyer. How many times did he say that? And then how did Sergeant handle that the first day? He says, all right, I'm going to go get you a phone call. And he comes back in and he says, you know what? I think you've been lying. I'm not going to get you that phone call. Not until you give me something. The message to Blackburn is clearly, until I give them the information that they want to hear, I'm not going to have an attorney. If he starts down the same road as he did the day before, he's going to hear the same thing he heard the day before, and he's not going to be afforded access to counsel or even family. Now, if you look at what he said that first day, in addition to the fact he was told that they're going to go to the judge calling him a liar, which I think it is clearly illegal activity on police officers.
Well, the English language is an odd language sometimes. People discuss, and I think commentators and linguists have discussed the meaning of the word but. And, you know, sometimes people say that when you say but, you cancel everything that's in front of you. I'd really like to get married, but. I'd really like to donate money, but. Does this but here cancel out what he says initially?
You know, I think you can think of it as disjunctive, meaning you've got two ideas as well. And, or, but, for kind of thing. And this is something he'd like, but this is something he'd like. What's the ambiguity there? Which one does he go with? He knows he has two desires. Now, does one trump the other? Maybe by the nature of the language, it sounds like it does. But I also think that, taking in the context of what he believes he can accomplish, I don't think that that the state has proved by preponderance that this man has the ability or the knowledge or the belief that he can invoke his rights successfully.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Starting off, Defense counsel mentioned several times the interview on the night of November, or the morning, I should say, November 9th, all the different times, everything that happened in that interview, and how often he invoked his right to remain silent, and I believe his right to counsel. And as I started off saying, the police aren't, or the state is not contesting that suppression. It was suppressed. We acknowledge that his rights were violated, and we're simply not challenging that. And I understand that defense counsel wants to link that forward to explain the motivation behind the defendant's second interview, the things he says, but I don't think that you can link that forward and say, well, all this stuff happened before, so therefore now he no longer trusts his ability to invoke his rights. I think that during the second interview, he still, if you look at his course of conduct and everything he says, he still believes that he has a right to an attorney. He says he knows he does. He says, I know I'll need one eventually, but I don't think there's one now. I think that, and we've been discussing the English language somewhat, it's about listening to people's tone of voice, finding their meaning, and finding out exactly what their intent is.
But is there a fair inference that it also goes the other way? Is there a fair inference that the opposite conclusion is just as correct?
There is an inference of that if I think you look at that first statement with all the buts in it and say, well, let's slice it this way or let's slice it this way and see how we can say it. But I think that if you look at it in the context of everything that's happened, both after that statement and before that statement, including the first interview, I think you can say that we can derive his intention as saying, well, he knows that he has the right to a lawyer and he knows he's going to need one, but he doesn't want one present at that time.
But isn't another fair conclusion that after he said he was not going to talk for 25 or 29 times, that he knows in his heart that he's not getting out of there until he tells them something they want to hear?
That's a conclusion I think that you could come to. However, I don't believe it would be a more fair, more accurate conclusion than saying that he knows what his rights are in the second interview, just because during the second interview, he never once says, well, the reason I came here to talk to you is because I want a lawyer, or I feel I'm being railroaded, or I think that I'm being tricked into something. Right off the bat in the second interview, he says, I'm talking to you now because I want to know what you know and what's going on. And throughout the interview, he makes several statements to, I've always been, I don't know what specific words he used, but I've always been forthright about what I've done. I've always owned up to what I've done. I don't need someone to speak for me. And I think that if you take that into context, it's not him coming in there and just nodding every time the police say something to him. I mean, there's a back and forth dialogue between the defendant and Matt Sargent where the defendant is proactive in saying, well, here's what happened. And I'm telling you this now not because I think that I'm on my last rope or this is the last straw or there's no way I'm getting out of here unless I talk to you. It's because he wants to talk to the police and he wants to find out what happened and he wants to find out what the situation is.
If the case is so close that we can sit here and say, well, it could be ambiguous, maybe it's not ambiguous, we don't know. Where do we tip the scales? Whose burden is it to show that it's not ambiguous?
The state does have the burden by the preponderance of the evidence. But I think that the state meets that burden simply because the balance would tip in favor of the defendant if you start slicing things up and saying, well, we're going to take this phrase and dissect it, or we're going to take this phrase or we're going to slice it this but and then ignore the rest of the statement, or we're going to say, well, this is what he knew beforehand, and then we're going to ignore everything after this, but then here's, you know, we're going to look at this part of the interview and ignore everything before. I think that if you take everything in a vacuum and say, well, we can look at this phrase about, I'd like there to be a lawyer present, and then stop it right there and say, well, that's an ambiguous statement. I think if you look at that in that light, then certainly I think the balance would tip in favor of the defendant, but I think that if you look at the entire stream of what happened from start to finish, I think you get more of a feel of what actually the defendant knows and what his intentions are during the interview.
I think when you look at the entire evidence, you may get the impression that the police officers think the only way they can get some evidence to convict this guy of murder is out of him, and there's a constitutional provision that prohibits that against his will. There's no showing whatsoever that they go to the site. There's no showing that they go take get fingerprints from any kind of a murder weapon or anything like this. It's almost like the whole investigation has got to come out of this guy's mouth, or we're lost. Otherwise, why would they keep browbeating him for 25, 29 times after he said he's not going to talk to him? Go ahead.
I don't know. I don't know why they kept doing that. I know that it was suppressed, and I know we're not challenging that.
That's not standard operating procedure, is it, that a person's got to say over 29 times that they're not going to talk?
Not that I'm aware of. I know it certainly doesn't follow state case law.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish the question.
Go ahead.
You're finished? Okay. Mr. Kinect, right before Justice Saber's question, you were suggesting that when you look at all this, it's clear. But I guess let me just ask you a final question from my standpoint. You know, if the seven of us in this well today have this much argument and have devoted this much paperwork, and including Judge Trimble, so that makes eight of us, all kind of disagreeing and wondering what does but mean and what does and mean, can you fairly say that it's clear?
Well, I think there's levels of clarity. I mean, if everything was clear as glass, then we would all be out of a job. But I think there's arguments to be made on both sides. But I think, like I said, is that the defendant's case, I believe, is helped by the waters being muddy, so to speak, by saying that, well, like I said, let's look at this and let's look at that and let's take this in a vacuum. But I think that if you look at everything from start to finish and listen to all the tapes and everything, it becomes much more clear about what his intentions are and what his meaning was. And
I was just going to ask, I mean, it doesn't put a tremendous burden on law enforcement to clarify.
Presently?
Yeah, I mean, in a situation, let's not even this one necessarily, but I mean, it really doesn't put that much of a burden on law enforcement if somebody, particularly if you're invoking your right to an attorney, to really understand, because they all know the minute he says, I want an attorney, they have to stop questioning
him. Correct, yes.
So, I mean, it doesn't really put a lot of extra burden on law enforcement in their interrogation. Would you agree with that?
After someone has been read their rights and they waive them, I agree with that statement that the burden on law enforcement to clear up any ambiguities is not as heavy as it is when during the initial waiver process. And I believe that the reason for that is because when you get right down to the crux of the Miranda process, the question really becomes, is a person fully appraised of their rights when they are making these statements? And I believe the reason why the burden is lessened on law enforcement after that is because a suspect has already demonstrated that they are aware of their rights.
Now, is this the typical reading? I know he reads it off of a card. The law enforcement reads these rights off of a card. And they go through each one and then say, do you understand these rights? To which he answers yes. Then the answer as far as the waiver, the only question as far as waiver is, says, keeping these rights in mind, do you wish to talk to us now? There's never really a question, knowing these rights, do you waive them and want to talk to us? There's never really that. Is this a typical question? I mean, I've
seen it done a lot of different ways. I think really when you get down to it,
are there some that read actually a question, do you wish to waive these rights and talk to us?
Yes.
It's been a while since I've been on the trial court bench, but it seemed to me that this was not, they had another question here on the reading when they read the rights to him.
Yes. I don't know if there's a standard card. I know some places use a standard card. I think that the point is not really exactly what the phrase is, but as long as all the rights are enumerated and the defendant knows them and they're waived. And I don't have anything else unless there are other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kinect.
Thank you.